Okay, so welcome to all of you. This is part of a series that we're doing this term. Yesterday evening, Rob already introduced us for the crowd that was here for his lecture. We've taken a bit of a cue from Tom Wright's book Seven Broken Signposts, as the Dutch the English title originally said, Zeven Wegwijzers. I think he's right that the signposts, let's say, are complicated in our day and age. And so, as we deal with these various topics, it's something that's not without complexity, for us. And that definitely holds true for the themes of freedom and power. I've taken two chapters. I'm not simply sharing Tom Wright's perspective. I think it's a useful book. I actually enjoyed the book quite a lot reading it. But we chose to use, his really nice, succinct division more as a structure for our lectures on themes that we all each already had an affinity for and have our perspectives on. So I will harvest a few insights from him, but I'm going a lot further in terms of what I'm dealing with. And that is already explicated by the subtitle that you see there. Do my feelings define who I am? Just for the English speakers here who haven't had the, advantage of reading the description, I'll read how I announced what I was going to do today. So, freedom and power, do my feelings tell me who I am? The longing to be free and to not be defined by power of others points in the direction of the Imago Dei, the image of Christ in all of us. There's something glorious that should not just be subservient to something else inside creation. We shouldn't simply be an addendum, a kind of detail to something else. There's something significant to us all. Yet the question does rise whether our feeling especially defines what the outcomes are, who we are, etc., or that the given reality does that. How much power do I have to define my or decide my identity? Or is life especially discovering who I am as something that was given externally? Where does the emphasis lie? When do we violate each other and how we approach each other? And is power over somebody else by definition a bad thing, etc.? So many questions. It just gives us a sense of the complexity of the topic we're dealing with. I intended to sit down because that's easier for me in reading. Can you guys sort of see me? That's okay. I'll speak up as best I can. When we're talking about freedom and power that's related to it, in this world, we have to be honest that we're typically looking for this thing and don't yet fully have it. I liked this little picture that I found on the internet once upon a time. It's a simple statement, freedom on the other side. There's always this brick wall that somehow we feel like we are a victim of our circumstances, we're stuck in the rut of a job. The one half of the population doesn't have a job and would like to have one, and the other half of the population has a job, is overwhelmed with it, and is jealous of the ones who have space to choose. You know, it's a strange thing that the grass being greener on the other side expresses itself in a million different ways in human life. And so far from pretending that I have, all wisdom and I'm going to solve all the problems here, I'm exploring something that is a dilemma in my own life. So there's a personal dimension to looking at all these various questions of identity and who we are and how we relate to each other. These two questions: how free am I, to decide or to define who I am? And which power do I have and which don't I have? These are the ultimately the leading questions. But a big warning here. It wouldn't be a lecture of mine if I wasn't trying to understand how we got where we are. So I'm going to do a kind of big perspective from two or three different angles and then zoom in more personally to what it means for us. And along the way, I have a few biblical texts that I think comfort us, remind us that all of history has been a wrestling with these themes. So if these themes happen to be existential for us, we're not alone. It's always been a struggle. As I say, a central theme of Scripture. I'm going to start out with the reading of two specific texts. The first one is Galatians 5. It's one of the letters of Paul. And he starts out with the bold statement, "You, my siblings," in the New Testament, whenever the word brethren is used, it was gender inclusive. It's hard for us modern ears, I know, but it was always intended to address the whole congregation. So we can better say siblings, you know, so that we hear it right, because it's meant for all of you. You can't pretend like it's, you know, if you want to take a Christian take on the Bible, you can't pretend like you're free from all these texts where the terms brethren are used because you're a woman, for example. It's actually talking to us all. So you, my siblings, were called to be free. Bam! Huh? He's basically stating this is, sort of the central theme. And as I was reading through Tom Wright, I think the part I liked most about his chapter on freedom was that he sort of marched through all the New Testament and showed how from the very beginning, the problem of being enslaved to things and how to get free from them is absolutely at the center of the narrative. And that the whole history of Israel narrative, which we get in the Old Testament, for example, is one about being in repeated cycles, enslaved like they were in Egypt, and then set free through the Exodus by God. And this is a thing which is celebrated. Even to the present day, the Pesach feast is maybe the most central Jewish, you know, a festival in the religious year. The moment when God redeemed them is a picture of the focal point of redemption, the cross of Christ in the midst of history. Jesus is not called Redeemer, as in free maker, for nothing. His mission is to come into, to break into this world and help us get free from the bondage of sin. And we'll see that in some of the texts I look at later on. But just look what this tricky passage does. You, my brothers, you were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Hey, I thought it was about freedom. What's this? Rather serve one another in love. The entire law, what? He talks about freedom and law in two sentences next to each other as though they are completely connected. Now, there you have a paradox, right there. And it's one which our generation, our time, finds as difficult as anything intellectually. To somehow combine a robust view of freedom and a law that regulates things. That's really, really hard for us to do. And it's because of the way that we've conceptualized freedom. We've shifted freedom into, what I'm calling autonomy. And I think it's very interesting to figure out when in history we make the thought mistake of making autonomy a synonym for freedom. See, for freedom is a much deeper and broader concept. And we've tricked ourselves into a huge problem. To autonomos literally means to be a law unto yourself. That's what autonomy means. And it cannot be connected. Yeah, we have somebody who's Greek in the mix. I had the privilege of having a good number of years of Greek, but then biblical Greek, once upon a time. So it's nice. It's nice to see a Greek individual recognizing some of the words. Anyway, the entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. And here's the wonderful secret about biblical freedom: the law is not an external thing in black and white letters. It is being cut to the heart, to an authentic place, to something that's driven from within us. Hold on to that thought. It's not just any old reference to the law. It's a law that ultimately is the law of love, which is seated here. It's not something external to us, but it's something which ideally is authentically part of us and defines how we live our humanity and how we deal with each other. Now, the other text I wanted to take is one which shows us how complicated human beings have found this from the very start. Deep inside us, there is a problem of unfreedom. So the reason why we wrestle with freedom is that there's some fundamental bondages inside us. Whenever you see in the Bible the narrative about sin and the flesh, when it's talking about it in a negative way, it's talking about these bondages, these things inside of us that have hampered humanity in being the glorious creatures they were meant to be ever since the fall. So, John chapter 8, verse 31 to 36. Verse 31. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching," number one, "you are really my disciples, my followers, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Fantastic statement. If something is really true, it has a relationship to freedom. It's actually something that we can use as an inverse test when you're trying to figure out what's true about the world. There is a relationship to the freedom, but not so much freedom from, but freedom to be able to do all those glorious things that we were able to do. And I will come later on back to this distinction between being free from things and free to. They're not the same. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The Jews that hear this, they answered him, "We're Abraham's descendants, have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" And I'm thinking, as I look at this, guys, you forget about, 400 years in Egypt, the role of the Assyrians, or the Babylonians, or how many times does it need to happen to you before you consider it part of your narrative? It's a very curious response. Nobody wants to be seen as unfree. Look at your own heart. If we find things hard around this topic, at whichever level or layer, we're not alone. Humanity has always found this tricky. We've never been slaves. How can you say that we shall be set free? Where's the rest of... I need verse... I wonder whether I've juxtaposed... Oh, yes, here it is. This is what you get when you're shuffling slides. Jesus replied, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." And there you have it. This is key to the biblical understanding of the narrative about freedom and unfreedom. At the deepest level, it connects our sin problem, our vulnerability, you might say our propensity for all sorts of addictive behaviors, destructive behaviors, idolatry, and so forth. We get ourselves caught up in the next thing that enslaves us as quickly as we have air to do so. You know, we slip from the one kind of slavery into the next effortlessly. And it's so tricky. It has to do with this problem. Slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So, if the son sets you free, Jesus is referring to himself, of course, it's son with a capital letter, you will be free indeed. This is Jesus Christ's mission, his project. He came into the world to set you and I free from this dastardly problem. That's what we're barreling down on with history towards the end game. And I think it's deeply comforting for all the complexities of the life that we get to experience and share on this side of eternity. Now, that other word I was using, I was talking about freedom. I've added one text on the in the beginning here on which powers we do and don't have. Freedom and power. There's something amazing in the creation story, and that is that we are literally given two very distinct zones or areas of power. And these two zones of power seem to be poles that we get stuck either on the one or the other side of. We find it hard to hold them together. So many of the paradoxes are found here. If you look at Genesis 1 and our powers. So, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. It's very special that the Bible makes sure that we don't, let's say, close out any one side of the human spectrum when it comes to the most important formulation of our glory, our value, our intrinsic being. It is stated beyond a shadow of a doubt. The image of God is only fully understood when you have both maleness and femaleness, when you see the stuff that's distributed through the whole human family. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, and here we get it. Number one, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth. That's the first side. This is a power of a biological, natural nature. It's a power that flows through our bodies. And for the Jewish people, it was always very precious to have offspring, a new generation, the future, living towards the time of redemption, etc., to be able to have offspring. There's something very powerful about humanity's place on the earth. Many in our time worry about it. We've populated the earth quite significantly. Billions of people. We worry. We worry about whether the earth can carry so many people. Maybe we should worry more whether the earth can carry people doing the stuff that we're doing. Do you know that 7% of the world population uses roughly 80% of the natural resources? And most people who have access to flying sometime in their life on an airplane are part of that 7%. Puts most of you in trouble, I'm sure. So we need to think about our place on the planet and, you know, how much we are demanding in terms of our consumption. It's a question of conscience. I think looking at even the models of the UN, we are discovering that we're reaching peak population, that the you know, population is starting to move in the direction of going the other direction of not replenishing itself. So it's a complicated narrative, this one. But we cannot deny that there's been a massive, biological power laid inside humanity, and that it has shaped the face of the earth. Of all creatures on earth, humanity has had the largest impact.
in terms of, even the future of the planet. And we need to understand that with this power comes responsibility. We need to think about our behavior, what we do with each other and with nature, because it has consequences. But there's a second power here. Subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and every living creature that moves on the ground. Natura cultura. Nature, culture. It's an amazing thing inside us. We are organisms. We are part of nature. In some ways, we're just like every other creature. Part of the natural order. And at the same time, we're capable of cultivating, using our creative abilities to reshape all sorts of things, to plant gardens and manicure them. And if you look at the Dutch landscape, you see that we make use of this space in great amounts. And we have a very, very cultivated landscape. I grew up in South Africa, on the mission field, in the wild. I'll tell you a secret, it looks nothing like the Netherlands. Not at all. And I always get a little chuckle when people consider us here in Eckendeal as living in the bush, you know, out in the sticks. You ain't seen nothing yet. Anyway, you have these two sides, nature and culture, and our ability to cultivate, to shape the world, is an incredibly powerful thing. All our technologies belong in that box. And here's the tricky thing. These two sides can be at loggerheads with each other. If you think back to the ideologies just before the Second World War, when eugenics became part of the package of National Socialism, trying to make a perfect humanity or a superhumanity, dangerous ideas. An awful lot of evil has been perpetrated at the moment when these two narratives get into the clash zone. So we have to watch out. We have to watch out. Which one belongs where? Which power do we get to exert where? And all you scientists working with the genome of the plant world and the human world, working with all the technologies that can help us get fruits and vegetables and all those wonderful things on our plates, we have to think about the distinction between these two powers. And at what point is the power of cultura destroying or damaging the power of natura, nature? And maybe most especially when we apply it to ourselves. And myself, I'm deeply interested in the developments in nanotech, where biology and technology are on an interface, where we're starting to implant retina chips to expand the spectrum that the human eye can see into the infrared spectrum, so you have built-in night vision. Should we be wanting to go there? Is that wisdom, really? Question of conscience. We've got to have these discussions because this asks us to. It teaches us that both these have their rightful place in creation. Okay, we move on. So this was the biblical basis for where I am going. And before I get into my broad sweeping cultural analysis, we can see that the Bible, ever since the time of Christ, for example, long before the Enlightenment, has been a document that has brought special freedoms into societies where there was unfreedom. So don't let anybody tell you that to be a Christian is to be stuck in a backward, freeless, captured kind of place. It has been a golden source of renewed waves of regaining freedom that humanity had been losing. You can think, for example, of
the time frame when the church was being formed. You had a very dominant Roman authority with massive power all throughout society, and Christendom became a countervailing force. It empowered poor, impoverished individuals, made them willing to be glorious. And one of the wonderful things about the early church is that some of the extra-biblical texts that we have teach us that they were doing things like caring for the babies that were discarded at the garbage heap, a kind of infanticide that was practiced in Roman culture. They did some really glorious stuff. They were motivated, inspired to do so. And the rest of society at some point took note. See, the Roman Empire died the death of decadence. They entertained themselves to death. A little bit like our culture, maybe. So, you know, we're running the risk of getting distracted there. In the main streets of some of the archaeological finds in the Middle East, you know, 100 AD, there are sex temples on the main street with phallic symbols as high as the ceiling. Go to Jerash, for example, in Jordan, you'll find such a thing. It's sort of in your face what kind of distraction they've gotten themselves into at that point. So it provided something that brought balance, and ultimately it impacted and helped shape a new kind of structure for all of Europe to some extent. But the Dark Ages soon set in. Not for nothing did we call them the Dark Ages. In the Middle Ages, especially the Dark Ages, think about 500 AD, you had the monasteries, the free cities that came to exist, and ultimately free trade later on, inspired by these monasteries. They were places that were trying to be a light, a shining light in a dark world, in a dark age. Creating a free space to have every area of life be valued. Not just one area, but things like doing creative work, singing, working, playing, having a liturgy of life where it was more than just ora, not only pray, but ora et labora, a healthy place for work as a sacred thing. Anyway, I could say a lot more about the monastic traditions that arose then, but they were bringing a kind of recovery of the good. And ultimately they stimulate the coming about of free cities. A city like Utrecht was ruled by the canonics, by the bishopry, though it was on the northern, boundary of the Roman Empire. It was a city that became a vibrant city, a place where the first orphanage north of the Alps, motivated by faith, that kind of institutions, caring for the needy. There's some beauty in the history here. Anyway, also with the Reformation, religious freedom came as a fruit of the Reformation. If you think in the Netherlands, you had many contexts where there was a lot of political unfreedom. In the Netherlands, we had the Spanish War, which lasted for 80 years. But there was a prohibition around the time of the Unie of Utrecht on insulting your religious opponents. So not absolute freedom of speech. A limited freedom of speech that reckoned with the otherness in society. And of course, it wasn't perfect, but this was motivated. This prohibition on insulting your religious opponent, on blaspheming them, that's the term that was used back then, that was something which actually protected us. For 300 years, we had no politically motivated assassination or death in the Netherlands. 300 years. The death of Pim Fortuyn was actually the first politically motivated death, assassination in the Netherlands in 300 years. It's a huge, huge breach. And it comes at a moment when society started to move in the direction of freedom of speech means I'm supposed to be able to say anything I want, even if it's insulting to my opponent. It's curious that those two things are connected. Okay. I could go on. You have the anti-revolutionary movement of Groen van Prister, opposed to the centralization of power. This has been a Christian voice in politics for a long time. Now, it was very strongly demonstrated in the life of a man like Martin Luther. This is a slide or two from an old lecture of mine. Martin Luther, he does an amazing thing when he says, "Here I stand, I can do none other." Now, number one, he's being completely free from the power of the forces that be, the Pope and, Karl V, etc. And he's saying, I am free to voice my convictions against the gale force wind of culture at this moment. I'm incredibly free to say what I believe. And at the same time, in the same breath, he says, I'm completely bound. I can do none other. It's the conviction of faith. This is the paradoxical nature of freedom. It is only because of his high connection to a higher ethos that he is free to step into this very powerful space. Now, just to give you, so on the autumn of 1520, Luther wrote a book called Von der Freiheit eines Christenmenschen, about the freedom of a Christian person. He sent it to Pope Leo X as a summary of what he taught. Now, that in and of itself is already a very bold and brave move, because he knew that this was, let's say, not going to go down well. He was criticizing a lot of the practices of the church of his time, and especially as those were sort of filtering down from the powers that be at the top. In October 1520, his books were burnt in Leuven, not too far away from here, on a big pile. On the 10th of December 1520, Luther responds by burning the papal law book. Talk about kicking the institution in the shins. He's basically underlining with bold letters that the kind of laws, don't do this, don't do that, and you can come and buy your freedom from sin by paying us an aflaat. I don't know, what do you call that in English? In any case, you can pay the church to get absolution, right? That kind of manipulation, he was saying, this is not from God. It's not the freedom that the Bible is teaching us. And when he is in Worms, gets an audience before Karl V and et cetera, the representatives of the church, he says, my conscience is captive in God's word. That's what his heart is tied to. It's a kind of unfreedom that gives him a massive amount of freedom. Huh? You feel the paradox here? He refuses to recant even any one of his 20 books that he had written, and becomes one of the sort of fathers of the Reformation. Thank you. That's wonderful. Okay. So, the discussion about freedom is as old as humanity, and is a central theme of Scripture. It is, again, I think, in our moment of history, especially relevant. And if you ask me, which themes really, really drive our politics here in the Netherlands, but in the Western world at large, it is themes like autonomy and freedom. Exactly how do we couch freedom? You have all these libertarian, libertas, if you look at ever since the French Revolution, freedom, equality, and brotherhood, I mean, these themes are resonating through society in all sorts of ways and really define what's happening on the main stages. Now, it often seems like we would like it to be an unfettered, limitless freedom that we have. I think one of the correct points of Tom Wright at the start of his chapter was that he said that we all know that freedom is necessary for people to be able to flourish. It's like all of humanity has some sense that freedom is a good thing. We don't like being captive, manipulated, dominated, etc. But exactly what that freedom is supposed to look like, that's where it gets tough. Total unfettered freedom is a myth. It's a fake and false narrative. It doesn't work for us to be a law unto ourselves in an absolute sense. Because then my freedom becomes your unfreedom. Now, if this was the only problem, often our culture thinks these other points are, it's only this problem. My freedom becomes your unfreedom.
So, if you say, Hank, you're free to do whatever you like, and what I like to do is to steal your wallet and do all sorts of stuff that's not so nice for you, then my freedom becomes your unfreedom. And this is all the more true with the expression of one's sexual desires, etc., you know?
So, our society would like to say, okay, that's the only problem. We'll solve it by balancing with a set of rules the limitations of my freedom so I don't damage your freedom. Now, number one, I don't believe we're being very successful on this score. Know that there are a few thousand women in a kind of slave labor in the Netherlands in the sex industry. Mm-hmm. Many of them brought here with false pretenses, their passports taken away, a pimp coercing them into what really is the most horrible form of slavery I can possibly imagine. It's in your body. You know, in this day and age, a 21st century nation, with all the means that we have, we still have that. The one's freedom is the other's unfreedom. It's a terrible paradox. My freedom to experiment with drugs, alcohol, free sex, gambling, porn, you name it, you can make the list as long as you like, they all risk enslaving me physically, psychologically, or emotionally. And we're very good at getting ourselves stuck in any number of this kind of thing. I have to think of somebody once upon a time who was here, addicted to gambling, stole money from his brother, had his mother take money from the till of the job she was at to try to get him out of trouble, and she lost her job. You know? It's amazing. The price. It's endless. The freedom to improvise when you're making music, for example. You think about that. Sometimes when you see peak jazz musicians sort of riffing and going off, it looks like they're just doing something. Don't be fooled. You go try to do something. It's going to be chaos. And chaos is not nice to listen to, so nobody's going to buy it. Nobody's going to listen to it. Well, I love jazz. Cool jazz. I'm a complete fiend. What they're doing is within a certain set of scales, you know, tone progressions, reading, feeling, intuiting, but there's so much structure, rhythmically and harmonically. You know, it's all structure, and they're playing the game, playing in the free space that is created by structure. Also, the narrative of unfettered freedom is complete hogwash. It's not the way the world works. And then the difference between freedom from something and freedom to. I often talk to people who are stuck in a job situation where they're not happy. And they typically have half the narrative about their next step sorted out. I don't want to be in this job. That's the away from part, to be free from something. A lot of our society's narrative is about being free from things, free from all sorts of stuff. We don't spend nearly enough talk about being free too. Human flourishing has everything with the second half. Good decisions about your career and all sorts of other things are balanced. You have to have a kind of balance, reason to move, and thing that is drawing you to something new. Because if you're only moving because you're unhappy with the old job, you're going to become a victim of the new job because you didn't choose for it. You were forced into it. It's the way it works. So you have to have a bit of patience to work on
developing the dream, the narrative, etc., to move towards something, something glorious and wonderful.
Free too. I could say a lot more and I'll come back to this. And then you have the age-old example of the fish who wants to be free on dry land. Sorry, it's not one of the options. And here we come to a point which I'm going to reiterate towards the end, but for human beings, part of the art of life is to draw between the lines. What do I mean? I mean, each of us has boundaries. Sorry to break it to you. It's true for you too and for me also. And we might not like that fact, but we all have things, limitations. And nobody has everything. So there's always somebody else who has a capacity and ability somewhere where you don't. And if you're going to spend your life wishing that you had those of somebody else, you've guaranteed yourself unhappiness. Yes?
Just for me to summarize, if I correctly understand what you're saying, it feels like you're saying that we are, in a sense, free to choose which we are slave to. In a sense that we're not fully, we can never be free. We either have a master or we are slave to something or somewhat.
I won't use the term slavery, but definitely...
Bound to
the law. Paul uses the term slave to the law of Christ at some moments, but it can be loaded with a misunderstanding if we don't define what we mean with it.
But the same calls for freedom, right? We can just have a big misunderstanding of what freedom actually means.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, but you're hearing me that I am espousing a willingness to accept boundaries. And these boundaries are not just true for some people. This is maybe at the core of what I'm saying. It's true for all of us. You know, I don't know who of you have heard the story of Joni Erickson Tada. This was a woman who, in a diving accident, broke her neck and was paralyzed from the shoulders down. And she went on to write some unbelievably inspiring stuff. Got married in that paralyzed state. Did a wonderful job encouraging others. And I look at the narrative she describes, having to come to grips with incredibly narrow boundaries. 90% of the stuff that we're used to doing, she just couldn't do. And yet there was a space within which she could. It says it is a picture in a very extreme form of learning to accept the creative space that she still did have, and to use it to the full. And there's a special quality to humanity that enables us to do this. That we seem to have an unbelievable creative gift to find space to express. But it doesn't work if we're only wishing to have the package that somebody else has. So, a topic which might be in the forefront of many of our minds as we look at our moment in history and our own complicated lives. And this is the paradoxical nature of freedom when it's applied to the whole debate about our sexual identity, gender sensibilities, etc. It's a theme which behind the Netherlands over the last weeks has been very much in the forefront of public discussion. But you have this problematic two-sided nature expressing itself right in the midst of this debate. Does genetics define us or not? For a long time, people have, you know, insisted in terms of the inclination towards certain expressions of sexuality that it is you know, genetically defined. There's a gene inside me that sort of front loads which attractions I do or don't feel. We're defined by our genome. We're determined by them in a sense. And it's an argument which actually is used to achieve a certain freedom to express something that somebody has a longing to do and feels wired to do, etc. But in the same pool of discussion in our society at the moment, we have this very strong narrative about gender, where we say, no, it's not the biological sex, which is defined by my genome, but it is the way I feel about myself, which defines whether I'm masculine or feminine or something like that. It really is an issue of prioritizing our feelings. And it shouldn't surprise us that this is where our moment in history is at, because we have prioritized the role of feeling already for a couple of hundred years. It has been a very central theme, and I'll say a little bit more about this. And I think it's clear that these two narratives are quite mutually exclusive. You know, they bump into each other. They're quite complicated, and clearly not both can be true at once, and therefore I think we're wise to ask ourselves, is there a third way? Is there another way of looking at the world, which allows for something that is not suffering from this thought mistake that somehow wouldn't allow for competing narratives to exist. If you look at our political systems, populism, as expressed in our day, is voicing a frustration. People want the right to say and do what they want to say and do, but maintaining your freedom as a group means closing others out. And we see this with a lot of the anti-Islam rhetoric, etc. If we look at politics in general, you see this paradox. This is a text attached to a July the 4th celebration. Celebrating freedom is more than 4th of July oratory and fireworks. It's a recognition that freedom does not happen by itself. For men and women to be free, they need the protections from tyrants and bullies, and sometimes from each other. That protection and that structure is provided by law and independent courts. So here you see society accepting this combination of freedom and law. Somehow, for us to have a free society, we need the rule of law. But I thought law was robbing us of our freedom. You know, it's this tricky thing. Are we going to allow a symbiosis somehow of structure? Now I'm going to skip over this one. John Stuart Mill talks about two kinds of freedom in a book that he wrote, famous political thinker, the freedom from coercion and the freedom to act. So here you get this division between freedom from and freedom to, also in the political arena. If I look at the biblical language of grace, I'm fairly convicted the freedom to is part of how grace works. You know the Lord's Supper. When we celebrate the Lord's Supper, you have these symbols, the bread and the wine, which are being used. And very often, we emphasize the part of mercy in the narrative. But it's interesting that English has two words. We have mercy and grace, both dealing with this meaning thing. Mercy is, I'm begging you for mercy. Please don't kill me. I deserve it, but please don't. Christ's blood and body sacrificed for us. But if we look at the meaning load of the fruit of the vine, wine, and bread, bread, that was the staple food. You had all the grain offerings in the Old Testament, etc. It was a symbol of sustenance, of life. And wine? Wine was the party. You know what Jesus' first miracle was? You guessed it. Turning water into wine. For what purpose? For a party. It was a wedding party. And he found that important. Important enough that his very first miracle includes enhancing the joy at a party with the production of wine. It's quite quite an amazing detail. I don't think it is by mistake. It's quite intentional. Grace includes the feast, the extra, the joy. When you celebrate the Lord's Supper, we're not just commemorating that we've been given mercy, but we're being reminded that we're being given grace to have full creative lives. We're being given all the good stuff. And it's quite universal. It rains on those who know God and who don't. You know, God's grace is very great. Now we'll skip over these. The freedom that we're tempted to want is this freedom. Jumping off the stick. Only when you see this picture, you need to think, what's down there and how high is the stick? is there a safe place to land? Because for a moment, yeah, freedom for a moment. Woohoo, here we go. I have these feelings about our narratives about love, romantic love. Mm-hmm. You know? Fortunately, in the English language, love is not just a noun, it's also a verb. Word means you have to work, huh? It's a word, werkwoord, we say in Dutch, a working word, one of action. Loving is not just falling in love, you know? That's how English, that's how Hollywood talks about it, falling in love. Yeah, right. Once you get involved in a love relationship, there's a lot of investing in each other. And I could go into detail about that, but...
Is this from Francis Bacon?
No. This is some modern internet meme. But it is our longing to be free. Is not always balanced. Now, autonomy. Where did the reformulation of freedom as primarily meaning autonomy come from? And I think it. It's distilled fully in the Enlightenment and Romanticism. But before I unfold that, I am going to unfold that. In the Enlightenment, the certainties and the sources of information and truth, tradition, the authority of institutions, maybe the church, etc., they're all wiped off the table. And we fundamentally doubt everything. René Descartes, I doubt, therefore I, doubt is a thinking process. I think, therefore I am. Even just establishing the fact that he exists, he employs doubt. Everything to be allowed to exist has to go through the funnel of the human mind. That's rationalism at the heart of everything out of the Enlightenment. The human mind is the touchstone, the measuring stick of all. But soon, after a number of attempts, positivism, logical positivism, empiricism, etc., a whole bunch of isms, we're getting to an empty bucket. Descartes thought he could build a tower up to God, and he ends up with one really solid certainty, and namely that's his doubting. And that's a very empty bucket, unfortunately for him. And so we shift from looking to the mind for producing all meaning and truth, etc. And we start to look to the feeling. That's what happens in the Romantic era. And it's significant that in the paintings of the Romantic era, this is a very famous painting painted around 1818 by Caspar David Friedrich, The Wanderer Above the Sea of Foam. And what you have here is one person alone. No community, just me and nature, on top of the world. Me resonating with nature. Nature is very important in this narrative. It's the nature side is dominant in this depiction. You guys ever watched Man vs. Wild, Bear Grylls?
Yeah.
It's a romantic ideal. Just me and, nature surviving, eating the snake out in the desert, to survive. I can do it. A movie like Into the Wild, it's playing with this very romantic ideal. It's so much a movie influenced by romanticism in all sorts of ways. The romantic ideal. The individual, not
tied. The narrative of Jean-Jacques Rousseau was, we are born as noble savage. We are born noble, but we're immediately tied up in a blanket, robbed of our freedom by our parents. No narrative about them caring for us and keeping us warm. No, we're robbed of our freedom. In the Enlightenment, we move quite quickly to the point where our feeling about things becomes very important, our sentiments. And this breeds, you know, the emphasis on libertarian freedom. The values of the French Revolution are also voiced in the United States. The Statue of Liberty, the formation of our political systems lean very heavily on a romantic ideal about being free. Free from. Up a little bit closer in time, when I was a university student back in the day, Nirvana, you had bands like Pearl Jam and others. In any case, this is an interesting CD cover back then on the album Nevermind, and it's free. It's like the fish and water example, but then turned around, a human baby. Now, anybody who likes babies has a little disquiet about this picture, because, you know, when is its next breath coming? Is there something that's going to catch this baby? And there's this ironic, you know, dollar sign on a hook. We're slaves to money. It's they had a song called Numb on this album, and it was about the place where we've emotionally gotten to, being, you know, stuck, wanting to be free, but caught up in all sorts of ways and frustrated with it and not able to express properly. If you think of the Netherlands, this emphasis on autonomy, on my personal freedom, has become so strong. You know, I grew up amongst the Zulu people in South Africa, and their communal values are much stronger still than they are here. Elderly people are respected for their role into the younger generation. Here, elderly people are put away in old people's homes, hoping that they're not too much in sight. Sorry, this is too much of a caricature, but it is something. If you're coming from outside, you feel it. I'll say that much, and I feel free to say it because I too am genetically, at least, quite Dutch. My dad is a Groninger from the north of the Netherlands, and so yeah. In a city like Utrecht, Wim Rietkerk told me once that 60% of all addresses are one-person households. Now, you need to understand that Wim Rietkerk came out of a family with 12 children, and they all lived under one roof. So he looks at that and is quite shocked by how many front doors. And it's not a moral evaluation as though that would be a bad thing that somebody had their own front door, but as a percentage of society, that's where it's tricky. Yeah. It's too much. And it puts our housing logic under huge pressure. If you wonder why real estate is overvalued in this country, this is one of the reasons. Society is a bag full of marbles instead of a cluster of grapes. The biblical picture for humanity is for us to be connected. I am the vine and you are the branches, you know, John 15. But we've become more like a bag of marbles. If you drop us, we roll every direction, huh? Autonomous wholes not connected properly to each other. Left to produce our own meaning rather than discovering and embodying it. And I pause to become silent for a moment here, because I mourn about what destruction is folded in here. We have a whole generation, and my work here at Libri is to talk to people who come with all their woes and their frustrations and their difficulties. And so it's not a theoretical thing. This is very existential. It has to do with my own life and with the life of all those people I get to talk to. We are a generation burdened with the narrative that we need to mix ourselves together with our feelings. While the truth, as far as I'm concerned, is that Nothing could be further from true. Did somebody ask you whether you wanted to have life? No. You woke up at some moment having life. Apparently it was given by some external source. This is absolutely foundational. This is the rock solid hard truth about humanness. You don't choose it, you get it. There's no autonomy there. It's not how it started. Yes, we are given a limited autonomy, but a fundamental autonomy is not part of the package. You are given life by somebody who also provides a whole lot of structures that we have to bring and bear. It's the honest truth.
My next slide, talk about relationships, family, friends, shared humanity, being responsible for all that which is entrusted to us. I'm going to skip over the slide because it's, in a sense, it's folded in the next one. There's a philosopher called Henk Geertsma here in the Netherlands who's done some wonderful work under the title Homo Response, the responding human creature. And it's very interesting. If you look at all philosophy since the Enlightenment, the last 300 years, we've been bickering with each other about the first and third person perspective. Is our knowledge objective or is it subjective? First person, third person. And I think that he's right, but the truth is that those are, submissive to or second level from the second person perspective. The second person perspective is when I say, hey you, and you whip your head. You're responding before you figured out, I wonder whether there objectively is a Hank who is calling. On the other hand, having a world in which you knew beforehand that Hank was there. So neither first person, I'm going to choose to respond, or third person, I have this objective view of reality. If you think about babies, when babies are born, they wave their arms around for a while, and at a certain point they bonk into things above their bed, maybe the rattle that's hung to entertain them, just often enough that they discover, hey, that's me. It's a discovery. We don't come into this world with a, robust objective or subjective position. When we look at somebody, look away, and then the baby looks back, it's frightened that you're there, because it's learning that reality is hard outside of us. It doesn't know that to start out with. But from the very start, when somebody addresses it from outside, when the mother lovingly Google Gaga's, the child responds, is comforted, etc. We get our sense of being an individual from other people, in the eyes of the other, to a high degree. I don't know if you know the stories about children that have been born somewhere in the wild and raised by a wolf or something like this. There are a few historic cases of these narratives. And in all cases, it has made them feel like something slightly other than human. Mm-hmm. You go read those narratives. We actually get our understanding of being human individuals in the second person. It is given to us from outside by the way others deal with us. This shows you how relational we are. Mm-hmm. And to what extent all the stuff that goes on inside of us is somewhat dependent on how others deal with us. It's the age-old nature-nurture debate. There's an awful lot of nurture in the mix, and we have to understand this both in terms of the givenness from our Creator and in terms of the way others deal with us. The second person perspective is very foundational. Now, as a kind of little hinge before my last section, I'm going to do a little reference to a Reformed Dutch philosopher called Herman Dooyeweerd. And I'm not going to try to tell you his whole philosophy or something like that, but just as to zoom out in terms of the perspectives on freedom, I'm going to mention his thinking about what he calls the religious ground motives. And he identifies for the Western world four what he calls religious ground motives that have shaped our understanding of ourselves and our place in the world and our philosophical narratives. So these are not individual philosophies or isms by themselves. They are larger, sort of underlying conceptualizations. And the first one he identifies is the form-matter religious ground motive. This was the time of the Greeks, where, if anybody has read the analogy of the cave by Plato, you have the idea world, the world of the forms. For example, the form of a chair is always going to be the form of a chair, the idea. It is eternal. It is hard, rock solid. We're materialistic in our day and age. We think this is rock solid. The Greeks thought the other stuff was rock solid. The ideas, they're eternal. Poured in concrete, so to speak. The chair itself, the material thing, it's going to rot and get old and be eaten up by a woodworm. It's the soft part. So you had the forms, the ideas, the ideal world, and you had the shadowy physical world, matter, form matter. This dualism, and a lot of the religious ground motives actually are a duality, are two poles. It dominated Greek thought, this dualism. And unfortunately, the early church didn't always manage to get beyond Platonism. If you read literature about some of the thoughts of the early church, there's a lot of reference to Neoplatonism. A guy called Plotinus is a representative of this. It had a lot of influence after a while into how theology was couched. And so even now, if you think about the debates around body and soul, sometimes we don't have them connected sufficiently, as though you had a formish, ideal, soulish thing floating loose from the body. But they're a package deal in the way the Creator has made us. They're stuck together. Yes, we're definitely soulish creatures, no doubt about it. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Yep, the Bible talks about it. But it's within me. Huh? In the same vein as I could say, this is my hand, I am also my hand. This togetherness is very much a biblical notion, and we have a hard time with that because Greekish thinking still has had an influence. But the form matter, what happens as things go forward is that often the one half or the other half falls off. That means that cultures lean towards the one or the other of these dichotomies. Now, around the time of Christ, the New Testament narrative, you got this alternative picture, which is not a dichotomy in the same sense. It's creation, fall, redemption, explaining why there is evil and brokenness in what was a good world created by the Creator. The creation, fall, redemption religious ground motive, it's something which in recurring waves we have to work at recapturing, because every time again, that other religious ground motive of our culture messes with us. Now, in the time of, after the early Middle Ages, the Latin Middle Ages, you get a dichotomy between nature, which has more to do with the matter side of things, and grace. And what's happened with form matter here is the form has fallen away and matter has become dominant. Nature, and then they need the other side, and so you get a sacred-secular divide. You go to church on Sunday, that's your sacred activity, but during the week, it has nothing to do with your faith. We still suffer from this dichotomy. Nature and grace. And just a time check. How late are we living at the moment? I've had at least an hour, I think. It's 20 past 12, okay. I'm going to be another 7 or 8 minutes before I'm done. So, in nature and grace, we get a kind of synthesis of form-matter. And this gives rise to a concept of a natural earthly reality. Then the Christian understanding of redemption is taken as a kind of antithesis, and so grace, in a sense, is loose from nature, rather than the natural order being redeemed. So it's the weakness of late medieval Christian thought is that you have lots of dualisms. You have the sacred and the profane, the sacred and the secular, the body-spirit dualism stays fully intact, etc. And it's a pity because, depending upon which side they put things, the scholasticism of Thomas Aquinas puts our intellect on the side of grace. And you end up getting a situation where you have to be very smart to be able to be saved properly. That clearly is a lie. We don't even need to be smart to be moral. Yeah? It often has very, very little advantage for morality, if I'm honest. We're just more creative at doing bad stuff if we're smart. So there's a thought mistake going on here. Yeah? And it's an unfortunate one. In any case, what ultimately happens here, though, is that as the Enlightenment takes hold, grace falls away. And ultimately, nature becomes dominant. And grace is supplanted by freedom. And so you get a dichotomy between nature and autonomy or freedom. And this is, it is so tricky, because in the Romantic era, biology was very important. Yeah? Back to nature was part of this movement. The emphasis on biological explanations for why we do what we do. Evolutionary thought comes out of this, explaining all our behavior on the basis of survival, of biological survival. So nature is emphasized. Here, in the form matter, friendship was the most celebrated relationship. Because biology dictates your family, biology makes you, you know, get stuck in romantic relationships, etc. But friendship, so intellectual, you choose it. You choose your friends. So they loved the friendship one. In our day and age, ever since the last 300 years, biology is very important again, and romantic love, the butterflies in your stomach, it's all that Hollywood can talk about. Friendship is a lost love. Do you know that the Old Testament story about David and Jonathan was the most well-known story in the Near Eastern literature outside Israel? It's the story about a special friendship. It's not a romantic story. It's a story about friendship. It's really, really quite remarkable, isn't it?
Just like
Lord of the Rings. Yes. You're right. Very relevant statement. So, nature freedom. After the Enlightenment. Now, to try and make this visual for us, I'm going to use a few art examples and draw it up to the present day to somehow give a sense of where we're headed for. By the way, biblical wisdom is always formulated in terms of understanding and resonating with the structures the Creator has given. Think about that for a moment. To be wise in the view of the Bible is to look around you very carefully and understand the creative work of the Creator. That's actually the source of wisdom. And I'll end my lecture with a quote that underlines this point. Often we have the formulation wisdom being connected to fear of the law, of the Lord. And fear of the Lord means awe and respect for His work. That's what wisdom is. Okay. And so you get in Galatians 5. So I say, live by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to sinful nature. Yeah? God's designs and some of the things we get ourselves stuck to, they're in conflict with each other, so that you do not do what you want. But if you are led by the Spirit, you're not under law. talking about this, the right kind of freedom. So I've already talked about this personal freedom. I'll skip over the fruits of the Spirit because they are this intention. Now I get to this analysis of how we've, you know, where we've come. At the beginning of the 20th century, you start to get in the art of artists a move to abstract art. And for a lot of us, abstract art is sort of difficult. You know, what's going on? Why? Why don't I resonate with it? So what's happening deep down in this transition is that artists are intuiting what is happening with the philosophers, and it's a project to try to create a new reality, to recreate the world. It's a kind of end game of what started at the beginning of the Enlightenment. And as artists do, they often are, you know, having that Fingerspitzgefühl, that sharp feeling, understanding where things are actually going. They are observing with all their senses open. They are seeing what's happening. Now, this is a painting of Mondrian. And the important thing is not to say, oh, that looks simple, I might be able to do it. No, you're not getting the point. There are primary colors here. Why is Mondrian limiting himself to red, yellow, and blue? What's going on here? The building blocks, anybody who's studied art knows you can mix all colors with these colors. He's headed somewhere. I did a lecture called Losing Sight of the Landscape, sort of trying to explain what was happening at the beginning of the 20th century. Piet Mondrian, born 1872, died 1944. Now, European art, up till this point, is filled with historic illusions, reference to nature, tradition, nostalgia, and detail. And things like tradition and nature, they rob us of some of our freedom to shape. If we're going to have to reference them in our art, those are limitations. They're limitations. We've got to depict the world that's somewhat recognizable to us. And so you're right if you're looking at modern art and thinking, I don't recognize it. No, you don't. Because it's a recreation of a different source. Mondrian embodies a transition, a breaking free from this historic tradition. 1901, he was still painting romantic paintings. Paintings that are recognizable in the style of romanticism, where a certain emotional, somewhat romanticized take of a lovely Dutch landscape is given, but it's very recognizable. The reference to nature is intact. But then he writes in 1903 in a letter at a certain point, dat komt niet in de natuur voor, maar het is toch geschapen. Het is als wij erover denken. It's a kind of discovery. He's saying, it doesn't occur in nature, and yet it is created. Namely, it's created inside our heads. Listen, guys, we can do it. Huh? That's basically what he's saying. We can create. And then, not just a little bit, a lot. Huh? That seems to be what's happening in the heads of the artists then, around 1903. And, by 1908, he has started you still recognize the windmill here, right? It looks a little bit like Van Gogh's paintings. But the big detail here is red, yellow, and blue. He's busy working with the primaries only, the building blocks. And he's toying with the idea. How can I remake reality with the building blocks? So, what do we get? We get a landscape painting, 1909. Yeah? View from the dunes with the beach. Well, you can sort of see the dunes, the beach, and the pier, but what you're especially seeing is geometric shapes, elongated rectangles, and so forth. He's geometrizing. He's played with the building blocks of color. Now he's playing with the building blocks of form. Form and matter. You know, some of those dichotomies and dualisms resonating on. This is 1913, it's painting of a tree. He's moved to Paris because he had to escape because he was a bit of an anarchist here in the Netherlands and the authorities wanted to catch him. So this is a tree. But what you see is that geometrization has gone full swing. He's busy drawing lines around the geometric patterns. So much so that the black lines are almost dominant here, the geometric forms. And then he starts to use this geometrization to think about, this could be a bookshelf in your living room, you know? It's an idea not just to recreate the world in your art, but maybe for our living room, to reshape where we live. This is in the Krullenmuller Museum here in the Hofvelia Park. It's also the tree, but you can't see the tree anymore. And by the way, the lines all the way around, the geometric forms, his abstraction is going on. He's just leaving little pieces of those lines and not filling in the geometric forms. This is the last phase of his work where there's still a sense of depth. After that, from 1917 onwards, no depth. No motion. He's moved completely away from the allusion to nature. And he starts to use only the primary colors, only red, yellow, and blue, with negative and positive, white and black still. And clearly, this is his apartment. He was photographed often in his apartment. He's using it to shape his world. Quite interesting. Now, he moved to the United States just before the Second World War, escaping from France at that time. He was very much influential in the U.S., and a new movement called neoplasticism, in Dutch, Nieuwe Beelden, was started. Ornette Newman was one of the leaders of this new movement. And he paints a painting, again in the colors, you guessed it, red, yellow, and blue, with the aggressive title, Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue? Take note, this is number 3. There are 2 others that got cut up by people in the museum who were frustrated by his aggression. So we see that people feel there's a certain, maybe it's an arrogance to this remaking. Listen to what Newman writes in an essay called The Sublime Is Now, 1948. It's quite amazing how early this is. We, and he's talking about the artist community that he's part of, we are freeing ourselves of the impediments of memory, it's this link to history, association, nostalgia, legend, myth, or what have you, that have been the devices of Western European painting. Instead of making cathedrals out of Christ, man, or life, we are making it out of ourselves, out of our own feelings. It's amazing how self-conscious. 1948. And it's really come full swing, in the 20th century. The artists who were busy with this neoplasticism, this attempt to remake, to reconstruct reality, they were rejecting the old allusions to the natural order and looking for a freedom to remake the world, kind of constructivism. By the way, if we look at the landscape, I was referencing the Dutch landscape. When farmers deal with the land here, just on the other side of the road, recently, the guy came in, he just bought that piece of land, he moved the canal up a few meters that way, dug off the soil up to this depth, put in drainage tubes, put the soil back, moved the back end this way a little bit, reoriented, there's no way that you can recognize the land that was there before. There's almost no allusion to the landscape as it was before. This very strong constructivist thing. It's not an anomaly that it happened in the Netherlands. Here, we can modulate and regulate nature. We don't have Mount Everest to contend with. In a flat landscape, a small country where you can basically mold, every square centimeter. You can be tempted to think that we can actually shape the natural order completely. By the way, it's not completely true. We can't reshape the whole world. So we may be able to shape some things out of our own feelings, but the deepest truth about the natural order is that it does push back. I'm going to come back to this remark. It does push back. At some point, if we violate the laws of nature, we get in trouble. We see this with our technologies and their impact on pollution and the air we breathe and the purity of the water we have to drink, etc., etc. So there's a journey from the Enlightenment through the Romantic. In the postmodern age, we start to doubt about whether our remade version of reality has any kind of link to what's outside of us. We really get stuck inside of our heads. We're asking about vocabulary. You know, when I say I climbed a tree yesterday, do you understand what I say? Or is the picture of tree in my head a South African flat tree, while the picture in your head is one of these pruned Dutch trees that go straight up? Maybe we're not communicating. You know, this doubt happened in the time of the postmodern age, and it's dominoed into our understanding of ourselves. In the current time, in the philosophy classroom, we talk about emergence, things that sort of bubble up and we don't exactly know how, and intuition has become the guiding light. Not intellect, not even emotion anymore, but intuition. Things that happen without us thinking about them, they just present themselves. Now, I'm going to show us a short clip before my last slide of a movie called Ready Player One, or I'll just play the trailer for you because it gives us a good summary. And it in a sense, situates us with where we're headed at the moment. So in the 20th century, we've slowly moved towards remaking reality. But we're not at the end station. The whole virtualization space. I remember some years ago, a colleague of mine, Jim Inger, who later went on to work with me there, he told me the story of a student that he had. It was apparently an American guest, a youngster, who was somewhat overweight. Was suffered bitterly from being teased, etc. Was not very happy, and he longed for the moment when he could put on a VR headset, wearable VR bodysuit, get plugged into intravenous feeding, and when he could forget his body and be anything he wanted to be. Anything he felt like being. And when Jim Ingram told this to me, he burst out in tears. Because this was the narrative of salvation for this young kid. To become free of his body, free of the impediments of a broken world, in a virtualized world. But as is so often the case with fake saviors, they giveth with one hand and taketh away with the other, namely, all reality. And that is loss. Supreme and ultimate loss. So, you know, as we barrel down on the moment when more and more of us toy with the idea of getting ourselves bogged down in a virtualized reality where we can be anything we want to be, I think it's okay to play with the virtual for a moment, as long as we remember robustly that there's a reality that it is mirroring, and that we go back to that reality to be well-rooted there. But when we take it as a substitute for reality, we lose an awful lot, and we become vulnerable to very manipulative, deterministic processes, algorithms that will influence your buying behavior like never before. You know, you're going to be making one more set of guys, you know, ridiculously wealthy as you buy your digital sneakers online, in the same format as everybody else in the metaverse is doing. You know, we're going to get a very coercive, where big data is the pathway into manipulating your buying behavior more than ever before. Just a little remark. We're told that what we feel is more important than the givens. And for somebody my age, I'm 53, as I get older, I hear more and more the echo of this message and culture. What really matters is that you feel young. And I'm thinking, really? Is that it? Is that the best advice you have? You know, back when I was in psychology class, I know it's a while ago, but they told me that denial wasn't a good coping mechanism. You know? Whatever happened to looking the truth about your position in life in the eye and embracing it? Is that really true? I understand part of what they want to say here, but I think there's a way to keep learning, to have a listening ear, etc., etc., to be excited about life. As a guy of 53, I don't really pretend like I'm my daughter's age. Maybe I'm blessing her much more if I'm simply being her parent the way I was meant to be. So, Ready Player One. We're going to take a little last look at a clip. I'll just play the clip and then comment on it afterwards. I'm hoping.
My name's Wade Wise. My dad picked that name because it sounded like a superhero, like Peter Parker or Bruce Banner. But he died when I was a kid. My mom too. And I ended up here, sitting here in my tiny corner of nowhere. There's nowhere left to go. Nowhere except the oasis. A whole virtual universe. People come to the Oasis for all the things they can do. But they stay because of all the things they can be.
Can you feel this?
Oh, yeah. It's the only place that feels like I mean anything. The Oasis was the brainchild of James Halliday.
Oh, if you're watching this, I'm dead. I created a hidden object, an Easter egg. The first person to find the egg will inherit $500 billion and total control of the Oasis itself.
Who is this Parzival, and how the hell is he winning?
Find him. Just kidding. I'm talking about
life
and death stuff.
The Oasis, the world's most important economic resource, risks nothing less than a war for control of the future.
Nothing less than a war for control of the future. It's a very intelligent movie, and it's reminding us of all that is at stake. People come because of what they can find or something like that, but they stay because of what they can be. There's this narrative about you could be anything you want to be there. It's interesting, you have this Easter egg. It's a religious illusion, you know, kind of a thing that provides life, and it's couched with, you know, almost a guru-like image setting already. Just in the trailer, you already see all these themes flowing through this movie. Very smart movie. Intuiting what we're headed for, the journey that we're on of having our feelings usurp the nature area. So having cultura via our feelings get to define who and what we are leads ultimately to a world where we think we have ultimate freedom and where we end up in ultimate bondage. Mm-hmm. And this is such a paradox. And I think it's really important for us to sort of to apply this to our daily lives. There are all sorts of parts of natura that we bump into, that we find hard at different stages in our lives. I just mentioned my age. It's a natural thing that I have to be willing to look in the eye and embrace. It's the honest truth about who I am, is that I'm 53. And I'm thankful for the life God has given me. And if I take that on board and stop trying to fight my age, but look for the creative space that the Creator has given me there, then
I think I'm on the right track. Looking for the wisdom that he has imparted in the very fiber of his created order. And each of us gets to do this in our own lives. And I'm not saying it's easy. To close, my final slide. Sorry, I just need to get back to big. I'm going to close with Colossians 2, verse 20 to 23. Since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of this world. You hear that? In Christ, this attempt to try to do it on this side of eternity, huh? The elemental spiritual forces of this world. Why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. All these forms of religiosity or secular narratives of salvation that tell you that there are all sorts of, you know, physical stuff that you need to do. These rules, which have to do with things that are all destined to perish with use, are based on merely human commands and teaching. Such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom. Do you have that term? They have an appearance of wisdom. With their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body. Yeah, harsh treatment of the body. But they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence, which is again tying back to this, the thing that's actually a bondage to us, and that's you know, the dynamics of sin in all its various forms. Real wisdom tries to see the structures that the Creator put in there and resonate with them. Thanks.